Well, it's very nice to have everybody here with us today. We have a number of visitors who are with us, and I want to encourage you to have your Bibles open to the book of Jude. It's a very short epistle right near the end of the New Testament in your Bibles. So have your Bibles open to the book of Jude. We started a series last week on Jude and went through verses 1 through 8. So we'll be picking up here in verse 9 in just a moment. In our last portion of our worship today, we do have a guest preacher, Greg Bell, and I really look forward to listening to him preach. I've heard him online several times. He posts videos and audio and that sort of thing on Facebook, and so I've had a chance to see him on video, but never in person. So I look forward to getting that opportunity. And then we're going to camp. A lot of our members here are heading off to the FC summer camp up in Prescott. So, like Chris mentioned in his prayer, please keep us in your prayers. Please keep us, the us referring to the counselors. The campers are going to have fun no matter what. And if we're all hogtied by the end of the week, it's more the merrier for them. So please keep us in your prayers. So I want to read verses 1 through 8 of Jude, just so everybody's on the same page in case you weren't here last week. And then we'll pick up in verse 9 and do a little talking about the book of Jude. In verse 1 it says, "Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who are the called, beloved in God the Father, and kept for Jesus Christ, may mercy and peace and love be multiplied to you. Beloved, while I was making every effort to write you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. For certain persons have crept in unnoticed, those who were long beforehand marked out for this condemnation, ungodly persons who turn the grace of our God into licentiousness and deny our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ." Verse 5. "Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all, that the Lord, after saving a people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe. And angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he's kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Yet in the same manner, these men also by dreaming defile the flesh and reject authority and revile angelic majesties." You know, there's a lot of ways you could sum up this short epistle. But one of the themes that I see that I want to focus on today in particular is the unnaturalness of rebellion against God. Even in verses 1 through 8, which we studied last week, you see the unnaturalness of rebellion against God on display in three examples that he gives. It was unnatural for Israel to reject their God who had taken them out of the land of Egypt. It was unnatural for angels who should have known better and did know better to rebel against their God. It was unnatural for Sodom and Gomorrah and those in like manner to go after strange flesh. So he says, these men in the same manner in verse 8, they've done the same thing. They've rejected God's authority. So let's pick up in verse 9 now. "But Michael," he says in verse 9, "but Michael, the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" All right. Now, it's always hard when you're starting off a sermon and you've already got to deal with a difficulty in the text. And if you're familiar with this at all, then you probably you're reading that verse going, "Well, I don't remember that anywhere in the book of Deuteronomy. I don't remember reading about that story anywhere where Michael the archangel and Satan were arguing about the body of Moses." Now, that's not the only place where there's some difficulty. You go a few verses down, and he talks about this prophecy from Enoch in verses 14 and 15. And people also go, "Well, I don't remember reading about that prophecy in the book of Genesis." either. So where does Jude seem to get his source material when these two events aren't found anywhere else in the Bible? Well, there's a few different explanations. I'm going to give you the one that I think is the most reasonable. And you can certainly open up your dusty old commentary and find other ideas if you think this one doesn't work for you. But I think what Jude is doing is he's drawing from the source of an oral tradition that had come about through the years. Because clearly, Michael the archangel and the devil and Moses and Enoch, these are people who are in the Bible. I say people. Satan and Michael the archangel aren't people, but you know what I mean. These are individuals that are found in different places in the Bible. And there's nothing about what Jude writes that's out of character for any of them. So first of all, he's not writing anything that's like, you know, way out in left field, or that's like outlandish or out of character for anybody like Enoch. We know that Enoch was a man who walked with God. He walked with God to a point where God didn't allow him to undergo physical death and simply took him up at the end of what God decided to be his life. So it's not like anything out of character is going on. And just because Jude draws from an oral tradition also doesn't mean that he's endorsing all oral traditions as if all oral traditions are true. He's not saying all oral traditions are absolutely true. But what Jude could be doing is saying, even within oral traditions, there might be these nuggets of truth that we find mixed in there. There are elements that we might find in an oral tradition that even though they're not in the scriptures, they nevertheless represent a truth from which we can draw a lesson. So even if this is just an oral tradition, certainly could be, but even if it is, look at what Jude is saying. He's saying, you have in your own tradition a story about Michael the archangel arguing with Satan over the body of Moses. You have that as your own tradition that has come down through the years. But look at the truth that's being shown there. The truth is that Michael the archangel, who is so powerful that he could destroy this and that if he wanted to, even Michael the archangel understood that he was under the authority of God, and he knew where that authority was. He knew where the line was supposed to be drawn. And even Michael would not go past that line. Even Michael would not go past that line. So where does that put the rest of us, right? Because if even an archangel knows that I'm not allowed to go cross this line right here, then what does that leave all the rest of us? Michael's faithfulness to God stands in stark contrast to Satan's unfaithfulness. And, like I said, the unnaturalness of rebellion against God in general. So that when these people who are disrupting the faith of others here in the second half of the first century, the people that Jude is writing about so much, when these people come in and reject God's authority and disrupt your faith, they just have to look at the example of Michael the archangel to be put back into their place is what needs to happen. And if even Michael the archangel knows, this is not my place to cast against you some railing judgment, but I'm going to leave it up to God. Maybe there's some practical application there as well. Just something to think about in terms of railing judgments, right? I've always liked the way that's put there. He does not pronounce against him a railing judgment, okay? Railing judgment is basically all that Facebook has become. Well, you know, 10 years ago, how old is Facebook, by the way? Does anybody know anybody who's nerdier than I am? Sorry, don't out yourself. But, you know, a few years ago, back when our moms and grandmas started getting on Facebook, remember when that happened? Back when our moms and grandmas got on Facebook, it was all just about sharing pictures of the kids and that sort of thing and taking pictures of your breakfast cereal in the morning. But it's like Facebook has devolved into the realm of the railing judgment. And maybe we need to look at Michael the archangel. And instead of ascribing motives to other people and always assuming the worst about everybody in the world who disagrees with us, maybe we just need to keep things in the context of letting God be the judge. Letting God decide between things, because God is the one who knows people's hearts, not us. And I think just a little practical application there to remember about this sort of thing. Even in his lofty state, the angel leaves judgment up to God. He is totally submissive to God's authority rather than reviling and railing. And if anybody deserved to be reviled and railed against, of all individuals, it would have been Satan. Let's go on to verse 10 now. Notice some other things here. Verse 10. But these men revile the things which they do not understand. They revile the things that they do not understand. You know, there's an old adage about that. Of we fear the things that we don't understand. Maybe in this case, they revile the things that they don't understand. Something that maybe vexes you or bothers you. You know, that math problem that you can't figure out. That puzzle, right? The puzzle. You got all the pieces laid out and you're going, well, I can't find that one puzzle piece. I'm supposed to find a foot or a cloud in the sky and I can't find it out of 1,000 jigsaw puzzle pieces. And what we do when we get frustrated, what do we do with that puzzle? We go like this and we shove it off the table onto the floor. Right, when we get frustrated by something that we don't understand. And if you don't understand anything about God, and if you don't understand what grace is, and if you don't understand forgiveness, if you don't understand righteousness, if you do not understand that man has an eternal soul, and that soul is accountable to God, and will be judged one day, then you take the entire subject of religion and go like this off the table to the whole thing. Because it vexes you and frustrates you. So they revile the things which they do not understand and the things which they know by instinct. Because when you don't understand higher level things, it's easy just to fall back on instinct. It's easy to just fall back on what comes naturally, what comes easy to us. And the things which they know by instinct, like unreasoning animals, by these things they are destroyed. Wow. That statement gets me every time I read it. Because the thing that seems to come by instinct is the very thing that's destroying you. Let's say your ship capsizes in the middle of the sea. And you're on that little dinghy, bobbing up and down, no hope on the horizon. And you're very thirsty. All that water, right? Surrounded by it. And what does your mind start telling you after a few days of unquenched thirst? Maybe if I just have a little bit. I thought I heard on a survival show one time. Didn't Bear Grylls drink seawater to survive one time? And your body starts tricking you into thinking that that's the thing that'll save you. So you start taking mouthfuls of it. You got to take mouthfuls of it and mouthfuls of it. And the thing that your body is asking for so ardently is the very thing that's destroying you. The things that they know by instinct, the things that seem to come naturally to them, it is by these things that they are actually killing themselves. Now, people love to think that they're right about everything. That comes very naturally to us. That's a very human thing to believe that you're right about everything, that you know everything. Experts in ignorance. The term pseudoscience is thrown around a lot. Fake science, right? Experts in ignorance. And the truth will make people like that look foolish one day. Instinct is not always right. That's a great thing to remember here, that instinct is not always right. We say things like, well, follow your instincts or follow your gut or something like that. That doesn't always lead you in the right direction. Okay? And even if you did have a face like Toucan Sam, it's not like that's always going to lead you in the right direction everywhere. A great passage along these lines is James chapter 3. I like the way James puts it here. When he's describing this very issue of things that come naturally to us or the wisdom that's natural, he says in James 3, verse 13, who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds and the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Now, that might be what comes naturally to you. But he says in verse 15, this wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural. Look at that. Natural and demonic. Jealousy and selfish ambition might be what comes naturally to us, but that doesn't mean it's what's right. That doesn't mean that it is true wisdom. There's a couple other passages in 2 Peter chapter 2, for example, that you can study on your own. But look at the second half of 2 Peter chapter 2 and see the way that these people are described. And by the way, if you read 2 Peter 2 and the book of Jude, you might notice a lot of parallels, though. Those are two really great passages to study together sometime. That's just your little Bible study tip for the day. Go on to verse 11, though. He says, "Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." Now, maybe you're new to the Bible and you don't know what these stories are. I'll give you the very brief version of them so we can make some application here. Cain was a man who long ago became very jealous of his brother Abel because God accepted Abel's sacrifice and did not accept Cain's sacrifice. And he was so jealous to the point that he actually murdered his brother. Very first murder that ever took place. Very first murder that ever took place. So he says, "You have gone the way of Cain. You have taken brotherly love, brotherly affection, and you have replaced it with murder and jealousy and selfishness." That's what those people have done. They've gone the way of Cain. And for pay, they've rushed headlong into the error of Balaam. Balaam was a man, a false prophet. And by the way, Balaam is an ancient word that means destroyer of people, right? It was probably some kind of a stage name that he had. So if you were like looking through the Bronze Age yellow pages looking for a prophet to curse someone that you didn't like, his ad would really pop out. A lot of those false prophets in that time would have something like that, a very dramatic name that they would use. Balaam, right? I'm the destroyer. That's what he was. So he was hired by King Balak to come put a curse on the Israelites while they were going through his land. And instead of cursing them, he was forced by God, really, had his arm twisted a bit by God, to bring a blessing upon them. But even in the midst of that story, he still teaches Balak a few things behind the scenes. He teaches Balak, I can't curse the Israelites because I'm compelled by God. But I'll tell you what, if you want to teach the Israelites something, send some of those women down there. Send some of the women of Moab down, and they will trip up Israel for sure. So even behind the scenes, for pay, Balaam was teaching Balak how to cause the Israelites to trip up. And perished in the rebellion of Korah. Numbers chapter 16. Korah's a man, he's from the sons of Levi. So he even had a special place in Israel, helping out with the tabernacle. He had a special job, but he wasn't satisfied with that. He came to Moses and Aaron and he said, "All of us are holy before the Lord. Why shouldn't all of us get to do things in the tabernacle? Why shouldn't all of us get to offer incense and offer sacrifices and those sorts of things?" And Moses said, all right. Well, tell you what. Go ahead and get some incense bowls and you go over there and I'll go over here and we'll offer these things up to God and we'll let God decide. We'll let God show us what His will is. And God showed what His will is because the earth opened up under Korah and all of his followers and swallowed them up. And these individuals in the same way have gone down this path. Like Cain, they revile truth, dignity, humility, and I would say humanity. Like Balaam who prophesied for gold, they've sold themselves out. And as well informed and as talented as he was, greed was the thing that overcame him. Like Korah, they have carelessly ignored God's clear commands for the sake of pride. That kind of covers the whole gamut, doesn't it? Whatever it is that might motivate a person to reject the authority of God, these examples cover the full range of what those motivations and emotions might be. Verse 12. This is where Jude's writing style really, really comes to life. He was an amazing writer, by the way. You know, I will say, Jude is one of those books of the Bible, and it's a wonderful book. I love it. I've studied it a number of times, but it is one of those books of the Bible where when you're looking for something really cool to read in the Bible, it's easy to forget about Jude. It's kind of easy to forget about it, tucked way in the back there. But boy, when you really sit down and start analyzing this book, it is epic. He's an amazing writer. He knows how to put together words and images, pictures in your imagination. You can almost feel things as you read this epistle. You can feel the spray. You can feel the breeze. You can see those clouds. You can hear things. It's a very experiential book. He was an incredibly imaginative writer. And here's where you see the strength of his writing really come out. These men are those who are hidden reefs. Other translations might say hidden rocks. Hidden reefs in your love feasts when they feast with you without fear, caring for themselves. Clouds without water, carried along by winds. Autumn trees without fruit, doubly dead, uprooted. And what is it about all of these things that kind of connects them together? It's the unnaturalness of them, isn't it? It's the vanity of all of them. There's an expectation with all of these things. And it never is what you think it's going to be. The hidden reef or the hidden rock that's just under the surface of the water. You think that you've made it home because you see the shore. It's right there. And just as you're getting to the point that you can feel hearth and home, you hit that reef. You hit that rock. And your ship sinks within sight of safety. You're not expecting that. But he says they're like hidden reefs in your love feast when they feast with you without fear. Oh, you know that? Without fear. Without fear. They come into a congregation, whether it's whoever Jude was writing to in the first century or anybody today 2,000 years later. These are the people that come into a congregation and are not held accountable for anything. They come without fear. Now, I think it's great for a congregation to always be willing to study things out, to have their Bibles open and say, you know what, just because we've always believed something doesn't mean we always need to keep believing it if it can be proven one way or the other from the Scriptures. To have an open mind about the Bible and an open Bible always for your mind. Those are good things for a congregation. But with that being said, in a congregation, we cannot allow just anything to run rampant. Because remember, in Acts chapter 20, one of the warnings that Paul gave to the elders from Ephesus who met him at Miletus was, watch out, because there will be ravenous wolves, and they'll put on sheep's clothing, and they will come into your midst, and they will try to deceive you. That's a fact. It is what it is. Elders at Ephesus, watch out. So while it is a good thing for a congregation to have their Bibles and their minds open to study things out and to be willing to put tradition aside if something can be proven from the Scriptures one way or the other, the church that belongs to Jesus is just, it's not a place of just complete open range. It's not open season for just every whim and every idea and everything out there. The reason why these people seem to get away with this is because they come in without fear. They feast with you without fear. They are not afraid to come into your midst. Now, I don't know what it is. Maybe the elders in this congregation that Jude is writing to were not holding anybody accountable. Maybe there wasn't real good leadership in that congregation. Maybe ideas were allowed to run rampant and people were running wild and every tangent and every rabbit hole and every new idea. But for whatever reason, they feast with you without fear. Now, we need to be a church where we are open to what the Scriptures have to say. But we don't have to be a church where we're open to whatever any man or any woman wants to say. We don't have to be open to just any idea that comes into our midst. False teachers shouldn't feel fearless about Monte Vista. I think that's what I'm trying to say. A false teacher shouldn't feel fearless about Monte Vista. Instead, false teachers should be scared of coming to a congregation like ours, where they know people know the Scriptures, and the leadership will hold them accountable. And that's a good thing. That's a good quality to have. But all these other things, clouds without water carried along by the winds, these are, now I know, you might say, well, scientifically speaking, every cloud has water in it. What he's talking about is clouds that you expect to have rain in them. You know, when you see the cloud coming, and everybody who lives here in Phoenix, we know what it's like. When we see it on the horizon, it's big and it's dark, and you can even see the streaks coming off of it, and you're like, and the wind is bringing it this way. And then for some strange reason, you ever seen it on the radar, right? The big green and red blob on the radar, and you're like, yes, rain! And then it does this around your house. I don't know. How does that happen? I don't know what it is about my house that does that, but I'm sorry, anybody who lives near the cross streets of Val Vista and Williamsfield Road, I'm sorry. I don't know what it is that I've done. But there's a frustration that happens there where you are expecting rain to come out of those clouds, but then nothing happens. That's what he's talking about. These are clouds without water. They're clouds that come with expectation but have nothing to show for it. And the same here, autumn trees without fruit, doubly dead and uprooted. Autumn is the time where you expect there to be something. You expect fruit to be there. And when fruit isn't there, there's a real disappointment. So up in Sedona, or outside of Sedona in Oak Creek Canyon, the West Fork Trail. How many people have been on the West Fork Trail? Yeah, that's one of the best trails in Arizona. Really great trail. But near the start of the trail, and if you've been on this, you know what I'm talking about, there was a homestead there at one point, and somebody had planted a bunch of apple trees, and there's blackberry bushes there, because it was a homestead. There's even an old barn there, a pigsty. I mean, it's kind of a neat little area. But when you go at the right time of year, you've got apples and blackberries just right there. I mean, they're just ready to go. They're falling off the trees, falling off the bushes. They're so ready to go. Well, I went back one time, and it was the right time of year, but maybe it just hadn't been raining enough or something like that. But I went to that trail thinking, like, oh man, I love you. Hike the trail and then you come back and have some blackberries and some apples right off the tree. And I was so excited. Nothing. Nothing. And it's not that it had been picked clean. It's that, like I said, maybe it hadn't rained enough that year or something. Nothing. And I'm a little disappointed. Of course, it was still a nice hike, so you can't complain too much about that. But look, I mean, these autumn trees without fruit, doubly dead. These evil influences have a lot of flash, but they don't have any substance to them. They might seem knowledgeable, likable, but they're actually empty and vain. They have promise without performance. They're the worst kinds of influences because they always have a lot of big talk, but they have nothing behind it in terms of spiritual substance. So he goes on to say in verse 13, in a similar vein, wild waves of the sea casting up their own shame like foam. What a picture. Casting up their own shame like foam. Wandering stars for whom the black darkness has been reserved forever. And that might be one of the saddest statements in the New Testament epistles. Wandering stars for whom the black darkness has been reserved forever. Shame like foam indicates the fomenting of sin in their lives. They parade around a belief or a practice that should be shameful while promoting it as something to be proud of. And I know we're trying to think of real tactile ways to describe this, but when you do go to the beach, nobody likes stepping on the foam. Right? If you're anything like me and you're playing in the water with your kids, you step over that brownish, yellowish foam. But these people, they toss up their foam as if it's something to be proud of. They parade their sin, gloat about their sin, like they ought to be proud of it. And you should celebrate my sin, honor my sin. There's a restlessness to people like this. These are the kinds of people that go from congregation to congregation to congregation and just leave messes everywhere they go. And it's sad that most of us have known people like this. People that just church hop, and everywhere they go, they just leave a trail of destruction behind them. They're restless. They're that wandering star, just a wandering star going through the heavens, never really finding a home, never finding true purpose, because they're not grounded. Because when you reject God's authority, you lose the only foundation that's worth having. When you reject God's authority, you lose the only foundation that's worth having. So it's no surprise they're wandering stars because they're not attached to anything. The gravitational pull of the truth just isn't strong enough to keep them in check. They don't want it to be. So Enoch prophesied then in the seventh generation from Adam, saying this, "Behold, the Lord came with many thousands of His holy ones to execute judgment upon all and to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds which they've done in an ungodly way and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against Him." Now, like I said, this is not a verse that's found anywhere else in the Bible, and this is probably something that Jude is referring to that was either from a secular work or an oral tradition that had developed that kind of fleshed out the story of Enoch. But again, that doesn't mean that Jude is endorsing all oral traditions as if they're all truth. What he's doing is drawing from this tradition and saying that even in your own tradition, you have this idea that you can see. That even among the traditions that we have about characters from the Bible, you see their character, who they are, played out in a consistent manner. And is what Enoch's saying true? Is it true what Enoch says? This was a man who walked with God. This is a man who God loved. And it's certainly conceivable, you'd have to do all the math on the ages and everything, come to your own conclusion. But it is certainly conceivable that in the time of Enoch, he saw the conditions that precipitated the flood in the next chapter in his own lifetime. Now, I don't think Enoch lived until the time of the flood, but it's not like the flood just happened overnight, like God just woke up one day and suddenly the world had fallen into complete and utter spiritual chaos. The seeds of the world that would be destroyed by the flood were planted long before the time of Noah. And so it's certainly conceivable that Enoch, prophesying about the flood itself, is saying, God destroys sinners. He destroys sinners. Now maybe Enoch didn't know that he'd destroy them by a flood in this particular generation, but what Enoch is saying is absolutely true. And I like this about this verse. Notice how many times the word ungodly is used here. The ungodly, it underscores this complete and utter separation from God. The Lord came with many thousands of His holy ones to execute judgment upon all, to convict all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds, which they've done in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against Him. If you reject the authority of God, you've rejected God. You are ungodly. Ungodly. And Enoch really pounds that home, doesn't he? And if you want to be ungodly, you've got to accept what it is. Ungodly. Now we'll end here in verse 16. And we'll probably start here in verse 16 and kind of use verse 16 as a nice kind of pivot point from part 2 to part 3 next Sunday. These are grumblers, finding fault, following after their own lust. They speak arrogantly, flattering people for the sake of gaining an advantage. Let's not put ourselves in that position. And let's be honest, that is putting ourselves in that position. That's a choice that you make. When you reject authority, it's like rejecting a rope that's been dropped down to you in a canyon. It's like rejecting the life preserver that's been thrown to you while you're in the sea. It's like rejecting the medicine that's been prescribed to you. It's rejecting sound advice and sound wisdom. It's rejecting truth, and it is rejecting God. Don't put yourself in that position. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, then you really need to be. Jesus put it so simply and so perfectly in Mark 16, verse 16, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." And if you are a Christian, and maybe the book of Jude is making you a little bit too uncomfortable, then it's time to resolve the things in your life that are leading you down the path of Cain and Balaam and Korah and yes, even Satan. So whatever spiritual need you might have, please let it be known at this time by coming forward as we stand and sing.